Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine. Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
And welcome to the show. I'm Lynette here with Dr. Samira Umat and Dr. Ken Pentland today. We have Dr. Jerry Mixon taking a break. Well, not really taking a break. He's at a conference and doing research, so he's gone. And he might even call us. We never know. I don't think taking a break is something that Dr. Mixon, he just kind of keeps going.
He likes to do the radio shows.
Yes. So if he's not here, you know it's something big that he's working on.
Yeah.
Yay. So welcome to the show. This is Leading Edge Medicine. And I'm going to go ahead and give you the phone number before we dive in today so you can get in and get your questions early with the doctors. 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. Call with your questions about your concerns, maybe a recent diagnosis, or perhaps a procedure, or the doctor was talking too fast, you didn't understand, all of the things that could happen. No. Bring it to us. We would love to talk to you and perhaps give you some information. So we have Dr. Samira Umat here today and our gut specialist, Dr. Ken Pentland. Welcome, doctors.
Thank you.
Yes, good to be here, Lynette. Thank you. Yeah, gut specialist. I thought about that and I laughed. Well, he's much more than that.
Oh, yes, he is.
Stole him from a gut clinic, yes, for sure. And he's much happier here than he was over there.
There we go. He's all ours.
And actually, as I was thinking about today, I thought that one of the things that's been top of my mind is, you know, the holidays come on and then the extra pounds just kind of creep back in. We all have good intentions and we all work towards good intentions and we all set goals for ourselves. But it's kind of hard when you are surrounded by food everywhere you go.
Good food.
Yes. And it's a temptation, right? Mm-hmm. People are cooking and baking and there's stuff. I mean, even in our office, we've had stuff hanging around. And where normally I would not eat chocolate, I walk by and go, maybe I'll just have one today. And one is never enough and it just starts the trigger. And so I was thinking about the new GLP-1 agonist medications that have really revolutionized the management of obesity. And they came about for the management of type 2 diabetes. Your GLP-1 agonists are Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, that whole class of drugs. And there are newer ones on the market now that are better for weight loss. But what we're noticing as we're using them more and more is that not only are they useful for metabolic changes, reducing type 2 diabetes and all the risks that come with type 2 diabetes, but the impact on many other things too. And it was the most thing that I realized, you know, obviously the studies were ongoing at that time, but it was how they help reduce risk for cardiovascular disease that really was very significant. And that's when all of our clinic doctors were trained. I felt it was important that we know how to use the medications and how to prescribe them, because heart disease is such a big factor. And sometimes people don't think that diabetes and heart disease go together, but they really do. Whether one comes first or the other one comes first is really immaterial, because they're both chronic diseases and they're both happening. Mm. Some families are more at risk for heart disease, and some people are more at risk for type 2 diabetes. But regardless, if you have one, know that the other one is not that far behind. And what you want to try to do is reduce the risk for all. And the GLP-1 agonist medications have shown that they can reduce risk for heart disease, cardiovascular mortality, blood pressure normalization, and also controlling inflammation. That's a huge deal. I've had people that will stabilize the weight loss at about, 15, 20 pounds and not lose any more weight with the drug, but don't want to stop using the medication just because they feel better because the inflammation is under control. And that's a huge factor. And I've seen lab values and C-reactive proteins normalize for these people where for a long time it was very difficult to control their CRPs. And so that feeling of well-being is a huge component in then making the extra effort for your own health and wellness. And the other thing we're noticing now with these medications is the positive impact on kidney function. Renal function is improving. Some liver enzymes are getting better. And also, when people lose weight, they have a tendency to have less joint pain as well. We've often seen, and there's really no honest treatment for osteoarthritis. We tell our people to take some anti-inflammatories, maybe to put something locally. Some people are doing stem cell therapies. But weight loss, we all say, hey, if you lose a little bit of weight, maybe the joints will hurt a little less. And so we're seeing that. We're seeing that knee joint pain is less in people who are using these medications. And that is multifactorial. But also another important thing is the change in addictive behaviors. Alcohol, smoking, other addictions. There is a decrease in addictive behaviors with these medications. And that is actually quite significant. So it's not just that there is one or two things. The drugs are having an impact on your whole body. We have already seen that for the first time, weight in the United States is starting to come down. Wow. Cardiovascular deaths are decreasing and cardiovascular disease is being affected. And so now the question is, how many other things will this impact on? The big question that I think I struggle with, and that's why there's a lot of research, is at what age is it safe to use these drugs?
Oh, good question.
There has been some question that people who will need certain medications that we know for a fact will increase your weight. For example, antidepressants. We all know that antidepressants will increase weight. Should people taking an antidepressant also be given a GLP-1 agonist to help reduce their weight gain? And then what about young people, young adults? What is a good age? Should adolescents be tried on these drugs? So we haven't had these drugs on the market for a very long time. And so we don't know the impact on young people. And therefore, there's a lot of back and forth and discussion and research into adolescents. So I wouldn't treat an adolescent with this until more data is available. But definitely for adults that are struggling, that have had issues with type 2 diabetes, inflammation, renal insufficiency, heart disease, degenerative joint disease, addiction behaviors, there is a huge population here that can benefit from these medications. And so if you are sitting on the fence and thinking about it, then please talk to a provider who's knowledgeable about that. Yes, every medication carries a side effect. And yes, I'm a very strong proponent for lifestyle changes. But at some point in time, we all need a little helping hand. And so the question is this the right time for you? And if it is, then what is the limiting factor for you? So do give us a call. We can help you. You don't have to be a longevity patient to come and discuss this with our clinic doctors and our teams. We do have a program and a protocol, and we will see if you're the right fit for it. Remember, I'm not in favor of a drug for weight loss. I believe in long-term behavior changes. I believe in helping you with a program so that when the crutch is taken away, you're still successful in your journey.
Absolutely.
And okay. So with that in mind, you want to go to somebody who knows how to help
you. What to
do. Yeah.
Well, that was going to be my question, Dr. Umat. We hear and we see on news and social media that so many people that are wanting to just lose like 15 or 20 pounds.
Yeah.
That are not diabetic, that don't need it for all of the medical reasons.
Right.
But they're going on it just to lose weight. I'm just wondering how that will affect them.
Right. And that's a good question. You know, originally when the drugs were in short supply, people were questioning these drugs mm-hmm. for diabetic patients. And if we use it for weight loss, will diabetic patients who really do need the drug don't have access to it? Well, now the drug is not in short supply. It's still very expensive, though. And there are other versions of it that have been created that are better for weight loss than for diabetes management. So you have to talk to a provider about which one is better for you. But there are plenty of compounding pharmacies making these drugs, too. Now, I know that in the past, all doctors had said, we'll go to the traditional route, don't use compounding pharmacies. But more and more, people are advocating for compounding pharmacies simply because it makes it cheaper for you to use the drug and then to get the benefit of the medication. So at the end of the day, this is about how should you be managed and are you at a risk and what are your risk benefits? So you want to measure your risk benefit ratio, think about it very carefully, and then go ask for more help. And Lilly actually came out with a cheaper version of their drug, also realizing that the market is tending in that direction and that there are more people that need help. So, yes, the drug industries are aware of this problem, but the medication is available. But again, be careful who you use it from. I'm not a strong proponent of, you know, I'll just write for somebody online and I'll get the drug and I'll use it for by myself because... Mm. It does restrict GI motility. People that have had GI cancers can, I'm sorry, GI surgery can get into problem with GI obstruction. People have been admitted to the emergency room in obstruction. It can cause severe nausea and vomiting. It can affect your energy level. It can affect enzymes. It can cause loss of muscle mass and not body fat. And so you want to be in a clinic where you are being measured. And remember, risk for medullary cancer, the thyroid is high with these medications. So always go to somebody who knows how to use it and if you're the right patient and to monitor you and to make sure you're avoiding the side effects. So we do have a program in our clinic and I would suggest that the program is better than just taking a medication.
Right.
Absolutely.
The accountability factor too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the questions to be able to ask, okay, this is happening when I do this, or that's why it's important. You can't just take it because everybody in Hollywood's taking it, right? All right, you hear the music. We will be back with your questions on Leading Edge Medicine. We are going to talk with Amy and Pam in just a moment. And if you have a question, let's get you into that call queue at 1-206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. We'll be right back. Grandson singing this, and I'm like, where would he have heard this? And I realized it was one of the little cartoon movies he was watching. Someone was singing that. And so he was, but to see a three-year-old, working 9 to 5. I'm like, more like playing 9 to 5. Oh, too cute. All right, we are ready for your phone calls. We have three of them ready to go right now. Here is the phone number to get through with your question for the doctors, 206-421-5757. We are headed first to Seattle. We have Amy on the line. Hi there, Amy.
Hello, Amy.
Hi, good
morning. Hello, Amy.
Hi. I was diagnosed during a colonoscopy with a redundant colon, and it sort of explained some of the symptoms I was having. About 10 years ago, I had a partial small bowel obstruction, and I got food poisoning, and never really came back from that very well. And I went to Bastyr. They did a SIBO test, and it came back positive for methane. So I did some kind of a treatment for that, but this is structural, so I don't know how treatment for that would really help a structural problem if it's going to come back again.
Mm-hmm. Are you having any symptoms now, Amy?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Definitely, yeah.
What are your symptoms? Can you tell us?
I can't eat a lot of foods because some fibrous vegetables really cause a lot of gas and bloating.
Yeah.
I've tried taking like sun fiber. It's like a guar gum type supplement, but that makes it worse. Mm-hmm. So it's just trying to figure out what to eat, how to eat enough fiber, and keep my weight up, because that was a problem too.
Yeah. Okay. So for the listeners who have never heard of redundant colon and don't know anything about it. Yeah, basically, as Amy said, it's structural. It is extra loops of the large bowel, and they're usually in the sigmoid colon. And so they can cause a problem. Sometimes they actually don't cause any issues, and you know, it's just extra colon larger than normal. You usually diagnose it either in a CT scan or when patients go through a colonoscopy and they find this extra role of sigmoid colon or any other part of the colon too. And obviously it poses a problem when it becomes a problem, and usually that is that there is a larger tract to go through for the digestive processes, so constipation can be a problem, maintaining weight can be a problem, and Amy's had that. Gas and bloating can be a problem, food sensitivity, so certain foods can cause problem. People are more prone to diverticulitis, so seeds and things can become a problem and can cause inflammation and abdominal pain and tenderness. And so then the question is, what do you do? And clearly, Amy's been dealing with it for a while. Amy, other than the avoiding certain foods that might be triggers, is there anything else that you've been treated with or been advised?
No, they basically did the colonoscopy and said, "See, we'll see you in 10 years."
Wow. Well, that's
the end of
at
that.
At least it's a 10-year recommendation.
Yeah, I was really, really happy for that. I mean, I had the diverticulosis, and I had everything else, but I didn't have to come back because I had no polyps.
Right.
So,
okay.
Yeah. And I walk after every meal because I know that helps the digestive process, but it's just like I've been doing this for a long time, and it's like, you know, I'd like to eat a little more.
Right. Hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said this was started at what point? Quite a while.
Well, I think it's been coming on gradually. I think the SIBO was a result of a food poisoning I had 10 years ago. But I think the redundant colon's always been there, but now it's causing problems.
Yeah.
And the GI symptoms were negligible before the food poisoning?
The GI symptoms started after the food poisoning.
Right. A lot of times we
would able to
see
eat a lot,
patients develop what's called post-infectious IBS, where they get something like a food poisoning. The story goes, I went to Mexico, I got sick, and then they treated it. But then ever since then, I've had these, you know, recalcitrant GI symptoms. It won't go away.
Why Mexico?
Well, just, you know, that's the standard. I grew up in Arizona. That's where
okay. I was wondering if there's something specific about the food there.
No. But some foreign country where you went to a street vendor and maybe they didn't wash their hands enough or something, or who knows. But something caused an infectious incident, and it basically triggers the innate defensive mechanisms against food, and sometimes that can switch on, I guess, quote, switch on a food sensitivity.
Right, any infective process possibly could be a trigger, right?
There could be genetic predisposition to develop a redundant colon or...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Or a chronic constipation can bring that on to you. And if you have diverticulosis, you know, there probably is significant constipation in the history.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of things can all play a role.
Right. So should she include high-fiber foods in her diet, or should she exclude them?
Well, like she said, to keep the bowels sort
regular.
Of... not compact, but like formed.
Uh-huh.
So you don't get buildup in the pockets, I think, is the importance of the fiber recommendation. However, you do want to be extra careful, of course, to stay well hydrated.
Yes, I would agree with that.
So 100%. The fiber doesn't turn into a brick in your system.
Yeah. Hydration, water.
And
not coffee, please.
Right. Anything that has caffeine or sugar doesn't count as water in that case. But But I'm sure that's a foundational recommendation that you're aware of. Some of your conditions.
Yeah, I drink a lot of water. I have to be careful with water though, because I have to time it so that it's not too close to when I'm going to eat a meal. Because if I have water in my system, it makes me not want to eat.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
Actually, that's a good way to not eat for some people that are trying to eat less. Drink a lot of water before you start eating. Yeah.
I think I have those leptins or all those different hormones because I just eat because you're supposed to eat, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. More people need those.
Easy satiety, huh? Interesting.
Yeah. Would probiotics help? I mean, for a while they had me on BioGaia. It's like an infantile Ruteri or something. And, mm-hmm. I don't know if that helped at all.
Probiotics, they're kind of like probably necessary but not sufficient in cases like that.
I wouldn't think they would be.
But
I'd want to dig deeper and see what's going on. I want to look at blood work and maybe a food sensitivity test or a comprehensive stool test to see.
Yeah, because before I had that bout with the food poisoning, I was regular every single day. I never had a problem.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, just came totally after that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so classic. After that trigger, you haven't really gone back to
I never had symptoms of constipation or gas and bloating until after that. I mean, I was eating beets and quinoa and broccoli and cabbage and I was eating everything.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
So, it was not, it's like a...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then, Amy, when is your next colonoscopy?
10 years.
When do you do?
Yeah, 10 years.
Oh, 10 years.
You just had it then?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just had it not too long ago. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I see.
Would an MRI help? And would it show more, say, around the ileum or any of those areas down there that might be affected?
You'd have to talk to the GI. I think a CT would be better. But more investigations is probably not a bad idea since you are not symptomatic. I do think that's a reasonable thing. I think what Dr. Pentland is suggesting is reasonable to kind of wait it out and see if you can, get past the acute phase and then have less symptoms. So choice of foods, knowing what your food sensitivities are, knowing what the gut microbiome is, therefore stool analysis. These are all very reasonable things. At the end of the day, though, if the symptoms like the weight loss persist, if you're having a lot of abdominal pain, if you are not able to keep any food down because of gas and bloating and your diet choices becomes more and more restrictive, and it is all because of the redundant colon, then I think you should speak to the GI people for surgery and having that excised.
Okay. Yeah, I thought about that.
It'll depend upon, whether you can control the symptoms conservatively or not and whether everything else is useful. At a certain point in time, they do work, but then sometimes you just get to the stage where none of that is working, you're continuing to lose weight, you're in pain. Frankly, how much can you restrict in your diet choices? I do find that it is much easier now today than it used to be ever in the past. But still, if they're telling you to avoid beans and dairy and cheeses and so many other foods in your diet, and you're like, okay, I can't eat more. There's more stuff I can't eat than I can eat. And some people are fine with that. But then there comes a time when you go, okay, is there another thing that I could do? So you do need to find out. How long is the redundant colon? Is it posing a problem for diverticulosis and diverticulitis? Is it causing more problems for you? And then should you really opt to go and have this taken care of so that you can get back to some better quality of life?
Yeah, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for your help.
You are very welcome.
You're welcome.
And I hope that, you are well and that this was helpful for you.
All right, it was. Thank you.
You take care.
All right.
Amy.
Thank
Thanks
you for the call, Amy. All right. We are going to go to break. We will be right back with more of your calls. Pam, stay on the line, and Marie will get to your call as well. And if you have a question for the doctors, here is that number to call. It's 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. We'll be back with more Leading Edge Medicine in just a moment. Stay right there. Medicine.
Medicine. My name is Lynette, here with you and Dr. Samira Umat. We also have our guest doctor, Dr. Ken Pentland, in the studio today as well. And we are talking with our listeners. And if you've got a question, we would love to talk with you as well. Here is the number to call to get your questions answered by the doctors in the studio today, 206-421-5757. All right, we are going to head on over to Graham. We have Pam on the line. Pam from Graham. Do you think she's heard that before? Welcome to the show, Pam.
Hello, Pam.
Good morning. I just heard something interesting, and I wanted an opinion, or if you've heard anything pro or con, about ivermectin versus chemotherapy for cancer care.
Dr. Pentland is shaking his head. Again, Pam, you know, we're not in oncology, and so I would have absolutely no idea. Which kind of cancer are we talking about?
Well, here's the deal. It is a person I know, and cancer went away, and then a year or two later, it's back, and they were given a time frame. And I'm all about quality versus quantity. Mm-hmm. And I saw this out of the blue, and I thought, who to call? You know, you guys.
You know, and I'm really glad you called, and thank you for your call. Yes. Unfortunately, it's really not something that I know anything about. I'm pretty sure Dr. Mixon would know, and he will be back next week. Mm-hmm. So, Pam, if you want to call us again next week and get his take on it, I think that'll be a great idea. Personally, I have no experience. The only time I had heard of ivermectin was when I was in India in my training. Mm. And that is a whole different class. And then during COVID, it came back up again. So I don't have any experience with the drug to tell you either way. So I will defer. But please call back next week.
Yes.
And maybe that, you know, we can have another semi-intelligent discussion about it.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear about the story. You know, it's always heartbreaking.
Yes, it is. And anything, I am so pro, try different things. Don't go with the, I'm a longevity patient, by the way. So, I will call back next week.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, happy to hear it. I believe too, that there is another, you know, higher power, and there are other things that work that sometimes we know and sometimes we just don't know. And there are alternative cancer treatment clinics around town too that do things that are not part of the norm, part of the traditional hospital system stuff. And some people have gotten very good results from that. So I'm aware of my own limitations in knowledge, and this is definitely one of those areas. So sorry, but I'm of no help to you today.
Yes, do call us back next week.
I appreciate the honesty. I appreciate the honesty, and I will call back next week.
Thank you, Pam.
All right. Okay,
bye-bye. Bye-bye now.
You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine, and we have one of our gut specialists in the studio, Dr. Ken Pentland, also a doctor here at Longevity, and of other things as well. Lots of things, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Samira Umat here in the studio. Here is that number to get through, 206-421-5757. Again, that's 206-421-5757. Headed to Monroe right now, we have Marie on the line. Welcome, Marie.
Hi. I had a question about high histamine. I don't have SIBO. That's been ruled out. But I still am having, so I'm on a high histamine diet, basically like no low sugar, low carbohydrates, fresh foods, no preservatives, and trying to keep my stress levels low. I have CPTSD really bad for about 10 years. And so this year, like, I'm finally, I feel much better. And I'm taking 1,000 milligrams of quercetin, three times a day with each month with breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And two K4s, which is K2 and D3, two of those a day, and Megasporbiotic to help with this particular issue. So I didn't know, like, since it's I don't know if there's anything more I can do. I know that there could be a problem with DAO, genetic issue, possibly.
Okay, so a lot of things here. I guess the first thing we should probably do, Dr. Pentland here, is clarify why is this lady on a high histamine diet, and what is it actually, and what is the necessity for it?
Yeah, I was actually a bit confused. You said you were on a high histamine diet.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Yeah, they have congestion. Like it's like
Even, so basically, for allergy symptoms with nasal stuffiness, headaches, and maybe low blood pressure?
I do have, it's weird with my blood pressure. It can be normal or it can be like really low. So it kind of vacillates depending on, probably my stress level more than something. But I don't know why it does that. It just does vacillate quite a bit. It'll go low and then it can go to normal.
Okay, so I'm guessing somebody told you that you basically have high histamine levels, correct?
Yeah, because of the allergy, like this post-nasal drip that won't go away, like trying to figure out why does that, or in the past, like when I would get dealing with the stress, I would go into vertigo, and it would cause, like my head would be full of water, and it was just really bad, but I haven't had any troubles lately with that portion, but it's just like this stuff, like I just call it like slime. It's not infected. It like when I look, if I were to see it, it's like clear. It's just going down from my head behind my throat, and I'm just wondering how I can get rid of that. I've tried Allegra too. That didn't do anything for me. Mm. I don't know why she said to try Pepcid, but that didn't do anything for me either. So I didn't know if there's anything else that I could do that I might be missing.
And you said there was a problem with DAO, diamine oxidase.
Well, I'm wondering if that's the next thing I need to look at because I have MTHFR, T677, and I have CMT issues, and I have another issue with the sulfur issue.
Okay. Yeah. Diamine oxidase. Vitamin C also helps break down histamines.
Vitamin C?
Yeah. A lot of people will take
They told me,
C.
though, to stay away from citrus with high histamine diet.
Okay. We don't have to get.
So I think that's why I'm doing
citrus.
Quercetin.
Yeah.
Probably.
Quercetin has it too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
So, what kind of foods are you allowed to eat?
Fresh foods. Like, you're supposed to eat, like, not have the food be sitting more than 24 hours, but I do it anyways because sometimes it's just not possible to do that. So I eat fresh vegetables and fresh, like, turkey or fish, salad, I don't do a lot of things that are mixed with a lot of, like, I do not do casseroles, nothing like that.
Okay, so high histamine levels, not able to bring it down with antihistamine medications, causing symptoms, especially sometimes low blood pressure, restriction in diet, stress is an issue, and then your symptoms get worse, and then basically you chronically had headaches or stuffy or allergy post-nasal drip type symptoms, correct? Did I summarize it?
Yeah, and then if it gets really bad, it's just like, I get vertigo, really. I feel just terrible. I get vertigo and stuff. Yeah.
Okay. And so the DAO issue, do you think that'll be a help for her, Ken, to use some DAO?
If she can tolerate it, yeah. I think that is, it directly breaks down histamines. But it is rather pricey.
Yeah. I don't really care about that so much because I'd rather be free of.
You're that bad right now.
It's definitely worth a try.
Right. You've been through the traditional medical route. You've had CT scans and you've ruled out sinus blockage and congestion and those kind of things, I assume, right?
I have not had a CT scan. Not lately. I have not.
Okay. Well, hang on a second. The music tells me I have to take a break. I will come back. So just wait for me, please. I'll be right back and we'll talk some more.
Oh, yes. Stay right there. And thank you for calling in. Marie, stay on the line. Valerie and John will get to you as well. Here is that number to call in for our...
for our Leading Edge Medicine show. We are live, 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. We'll be back with more Leading Edge Medicine in just a moment. Stay right there.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started in to hum. Still, it's a real good bet. The best is yet to come.
And welcome back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. So glad you've tuned in this morning. We are live in the studio. I'm Lynette, here along with Dr. Samira Umat and Dr. Ken Pentland. Dr. Jerry Nixon is off this weekend. We're talking with Marie about histamines, histamine diets, high histamine.
I was thinking of something else when, you know, in between, you know, talking with you. I had a mold exposure, and that hasn't been, like, I haven't, my IgG and IgE, whatever it is, they're high, so I still have work to do with that. So that could be a possible contributing factor to this.
Sure. I mean, I think that's what Dr. Pentland and I were saying, that I think there's more to the story here than we are understanding right now. And on the radio, it'll probably be hard, but I do think that you do need a thorough evaluation. The symptoms sound like an ear, nose, and throat type of an issue. And certainly, you seem like you've done some of the deep dive into it, but maybe then you delved into some of the holistic. But I don't know whether you had food sensitivity testing done or not. And I think that's probably one of the important things that you should get done. And also after that, just basic investigations like a CT scan for me would be very important. Vertigo is, you know, a symptom that can sometimes be easily treated and sometimes is really, really hard. And so I would probably want more eyes on this so that I would have more test results to be able to help you. Definitely a high histamine diet, you'd probably be one of my first patients that I've heard say that. So that's a new one for me.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate your help and ideas.
Yeah,
thanks so much.
Welcome. Dr. Pentland, do you have anything more to add today?
I mean, histamine is such a multifactorial result. It seems more like a symptom than a cause or than a
result. Histamine reaction is a life-saving reaction, right? Your body mounts that reaction in response to an allergy, but I can understand if it's chronically elevated for some reason, it's causing you some issues. You've mentioned one that is probably a little bit under your control, in that stress management. But then stress can't explain all of the other things either, so there's more to the story here.
Yeah. Some kind of
I've had a food allergy test, so not food allergy.
It's not food allergies. Maybe. Okay, well that's good to know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good to know.
But you know, we'll see if about the next step.
I was sympathetic when people are symptomatic. There's a problem she's experiencing, and the question is, what is causing it? And if some things in diet and lifestyle can make a difference and change her symptoms, obviously that's where we want to go. But there's more going on over here. You have vertigo, you're dropping your blood pressure sometimes, and clearly you have some histamine reactions with allergies and nasal and sinus congestion, which may or may not be contributing to some of the vertigo symptoms as well. Vertigo, traditionally, again, you know, inner ear is the first thing that we think of. If it's benign positional, you would have known that by now if you've been seeing medical providers. The symptoms are classic, and treatment for that can help, control the symptoms. And that's just crystals in the inner ear. But seems like that's not what you're dealing with. You're dealing with something.
I have in the past. So, but it seems too that when I went into the room, where I didn't realize my acupuncturist, there was mold all over the place. So I'd be fine, then go in there, but after the treatment, feel worse. Go into vertigo after being in there. So I think that's maybe part of the piece to the puzzle. I'm not going there anymore.
I'm certainly hearing a lot more about that. Mold exposure and mold toxicity, it definitely is a thing. You know, Dr. Mark Hyman has talked about his personal life and his exposure to mold, which literally almost killed him until he figured out what was going on, and then he was able to get out of it. So definitely, if mold or mycotoxins are playing a role, it is not an easy thing to treat, as we said on our last show today, but definitely something that you should keep an open mind to, if certainly if you are under current exposure as well.
Right. Well, that we're having our house redone now, so it'll be better when I move back, too, because there was some in our house. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and we live in the Pacific Northwest. I think it's something that we can't get away from.
It's hard to get away from.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah. Yes. So a lot of people are exposed to it, and our body does accommodate and respond to it. And then sometimes just, you know, either with genetic makeup or overexposure, sometimes just things break. And then you have to say, okay, what do I fix here?
Right. Well, thank you very much. Have a nice day.
You're welcome. Good luck to you.
Thank you for the call, Marie. We'll continue now taking your calls. This is Leading Edge Medicine, and here is the phone number to get through, just like Marie, Pam, and Amy did this morning. 206-421-5757. Headed to Issaquah now, we have Valerie on the line. Hi, Valerie. Welcome.
Hello, Valerie.
Hi, Valerie. Good morning. Thank you. I've got hopefully a very quick question. My husband, 70 years of age, has ice cold hands and feet. Blood pressure runs about 140/70, taking zero BP meds. Any other medical tests of his all run straight down the midline on every test, with the exception of the creatinine albumin ratio. That's it. That's the only thing that's out of line.
Okay. And how long has he had cold hands and feet?
Oh, I'd say we're dealing with this for several months now. And when we're talking cold, we're talking as if his hands have been in the freezer cold.
Oh, wow.
If you cold dead hands is kind of how I describe it.
Wow, and that's unusual for it to appear so suddenly. Now, Valerie, does he have any skin changes? Does it become painful? Does the skin become blue, purple, and then pink in color? Does it change color?
No, hands don't change color.
And it's cold all the time?
Yes, it does not get better throughout the day.
And no numbness or tingling in the hands or feet?
No, he's a type 3 diabetic, but I don't know if blood sugar has any impact on this.
Sure,
or
it
not.
Does. It sure it does.
Okay.
The higher the blood sugar level, the more likelihood people will develop peripheral neuropathies. Mm-hmm. And so peripheral neuropathies are either vascular or they can be nerve, but either one can be damaged with high sugar. And when that happens, then the first symptoms are numbness or tingling or just cold extremities.
Okay.
And the other thing, I know you mentioned that you have done his labs and everything is right down the middle. Does he complain of being cold all the time?
He, as of late, he complains of being a little bit cold, but not outrageously cold. For him, though, this is unusual because he's always been a great warm body. I've always been able to warm up my hands and feet on him.
I know that's why we get married, right?
I do have a question. You mentioned he has type 3 diabetes or type 2 diabetes?
We look at that as type 3. We're stage 5-6 Alzheimer's right now.
I see. Okay, so that is, you know, neurological condition, so it's not really glucose and insulin dysregulation. Type 1 and type 2 diabetes are more glucose and insulin dysregulation. With the neurological, peripheral neuropathies can present with that sometimes. But the other thing I would check is thyroid, because it is very common that people get cold hands and feet if the TSH runs a little on the higher side and free T3 and free T4 drop. So that is something. If they haven't done reverse T3, free T4 levels, I will definitely look into that. And then if it's hands, okay, so the music tells me that I have to go to a break. Can you hold for a quick minute? And when I come back, let's continue to talk, okay?
Yes. We'll take a quick break here, and we will be back with more Leading Edge Medicine. Here's that number to get through with your call. We have one more hour to go, 206-421-5757. We'll be right back.
This is...